This fall. Well, isn't that one of the problems? Like, I don't know if you're going to be allowed. I don't know if there's sporting events that are going to be allowed in schools. We don't seem to be allowing them in the public at large. So I don't know if that's going to be allowed. I don't know if you have a social cohort where you're doing your hockey outside of school, if you're going to be allowed to participate in a social cohort in school. So these are some of the considerations people have to say. These are some of the issues that have been raised with me from parents. Another person says, my kids will 100%. We are going back to the classroom. Well, let's see what we're hearing from my next guest. And we'll also talk to Lisa Davis as well. But the main thing is that the opportunity to sign up for at-home learning, you got to make your decision today. And I believe you're locked into the decision that you make until February, at which point you can make a different choice. Some people have been asking me, what's the difference between signing up for Hub Learning through the Calgary Board of Education or the Calgary Catholic Board versus signing up for homeschooling and doing it independently? Well, we'll talk to Judy Arnell to discuss that. She is president of the Alberta Homeschooling Association and joins us now to talk it through. Judy, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us what is different about homeschooling versus hub schooling, which the school boards are offering. Because I think people are sort of thinking, well, maybe I still want to be tied to my particular school board. Maybe I don't want to just cut it completely and go homeschooling. Give us an idea of the difference between the two.
Okay. First of all, there's no such term as homeschooling in Alberta education. It's called home education. Okay. And that's the only program where parents direct or lead the program. The difference is that parents can decide whatever they want to teach. There's funding for them for reimbursable expenses, and children can still get diplomas on the program, but there's no tests or attendance requirements. There's it's parents decide everything. They're in charge.
Okay, and what is the amount of money? I've been hoping that the government would boost the amount to make it more affordable, because curriculum is expensive, but I don't think they've made that decision to. But tell us how much the parents get for each child that they decide to home educate.
Well, parents get $850 per child per year to offset the cost of supplies, lessons, things like that. The school authority also gets funding for supervising the home education program, and it can be the public schools, the charters, the Catholic schools, or an independent school that supervises the program.
Does every parent who signs up for home education have to have a relationship with a public charter or independent school?
They don't have to. New this year is they can notify directly with the government and not receive funding or receive any supervision or help. But we're finding parents this year they're totally new to home education. They need a lot of hand-holding and support, and they need funding. So we're encouraging them to go back to their school board and say, I want to do parent-led home education.
Okay, so this is what I'm trying to understand, is if you choose the hub option where you begin to virtual school right from the get-go, are you still going to get that $850? Will the school boards acknowledge it as a home education program so that you can get the resources to help? Or does all the money for your child go to the school board that's offering the virtual learning?
Yeah, and that's the big difference, is there are two programs in Alberta education. There's home education, which is totally parent-controlled and gets funding. What you're talking about, the hub, what Calgary Catholic, what Calgary Board of Ed, Edmonton are all putting out is distance education. So it's not so much of where the learning takes place, it's a matter of who controls it. So the only parent-controlled program is home education. Everything else, whether it's called at-home learning or home-based learning, or even some school boards are calling it homeschooling, that is distance education and no funding. That is school, but in your living room. And you as a parent are not the teacher of those programs. You are the homework enforcer.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, here's the thing. I can understand why there wouldn't be additional funding flowing through, because if you don't have to go online and buy curriculum and do the marking yourself, then maybe there's less need to compensate. But give me an idea of how expensive, if you decide that you're going to just do the virtual distance programming and not be responsible for choosing your own curriculum. If you decide that to go that route, fine, you're not going to get resources. But if you get the $850, how far does that go towards covering the cost of all of the additional supplies and access to resources that you're going to need? Are parents going to be out of pocket, or can you make it work for $850?
Some parents can make it work, especially if they've been doing this for years and have lots of kids. but if you're starting out, and especially for parents with children in high school, those textbooks are $170 a pop. It does not go far enough. The other thing, too, is parents do not have to teach under home education. They can outsource to tutors, freelance teachers, online a la carte courses from other countries, and those things cost money. So no, it doesn't cover anybody's home education, everything they need. They definitely do have to dip out of pocket. And we're always saying parents should get a tax credit for the money they do, because they save public schools a lot of money. I homeschooled my 5 children, and I've saved taxpayers over $500,000, because we don't fund parents to teach. We fund teachers to teach under distance education.
Less than talk about your experience about, even though over the course of your 5 kids that you may have broken even, although it sounds like you probably put in a lot more resources. What's the benefit of doing that? Like, why would somebody be prepared to pay more money for their kids' education than choosing one of the other options where they don't have to pay at all?
Well, parents have their children's best interests in mind, and a lot of parents have children with special needs that they can better meet at home. And, you know, they want their children to get a diploma but have a more meaningful education, especially a hands-on education, where they're not online all the time, they're not in front of a screen. And they choose home education because it's much more flexible. They can personalize it to children. And all children can get a diploma under home education programs. And it takes about a tenth of the time as school. It's so much more efficient. So
talk about that, actually, because I think that's such an advantage, especially for those who have large families and want to be able to do other activities with their families. Why is it less time intensive? Tell us what your experience was.
Well, it takes much less time, because I use the dinner party analogy that if you're having 30 people over for dinner, think of the time it takes to plan and execute and clean up. Whereas if you're just having dinner with your one child, it takes way less time. And that's what home education parents find. As well, too, it's more socially diverse, because children get out in the community. We don't stay at home. We get out there and we socialize with all kinds of people, ages, backgrounds. It's a much more personalized experience.
What did you find about issue of sports? Because I think that's one of the attractions for, I've talked to homeschool families who send their kids back to school once they get into high school, for instance. How did you, I don't know if your kids were athletic. Did you fill the gap in a different way?
Yes, we just outsourced to the rec centers because home education gets funding. The business community has stepped up and offered daytime sports programs. And we even had a daytime Girl Guide Boy Scout program. They are stepping up to meet a need of parents wanting these activities for the children through the day.
One other thing, for kids who are looking at going to university, is there any deficiency in a homeschool diploma that has to be corrected before they can go on to university? Or have they worked out whether they're synchronized?
So if a child does home education all the way up to grade 12. They can very much personalize their education, but everybody writes the same diploma exams. We do not write PATs. There's no testing. There's no attendance on home ed. But everybody needs diploma exams for marks and credits. So they get a diploma exam mark, and that's what they present to post-secondaries when they apply. So no one knows they've been home educated or not. It just has a school code on the transcript.
All right. Now, for parents who are thinking, I can't do this. It's going to cost me more money. It's going to be too time intensive. I don't know. I wasn't good at, I don't know, name it, spelling in school or math in school or science in school. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could teach the full curriculum. What would you say to give them some confidence?
I would say kids are going to learn whether you teach them or not. And I think that's a big worry this year is parents don't want their kids to get behind. So they're feeling forced to sign up for online or in classroom. And yet, we've laid it out for them. There's step-by-step curriculum for them on our website, and that kids are going to keep learning. And by age 13, they actually surpass parents' knowledge, and they have research skills. They learn things on the internet or through the library, and they just keep going, and they can get everything they need for post-secondary admittance through home education. Don't worry.
One last question is people are worried that if I sign up for homeschool now, get the $850, sever my relationship with the board, if it's not working out for me, I won't be able to send my kid back to school in February. Is that a choice that people have to make?
Not at all. Every public school board has to accept children in their boundaries. And whether they come from home education or come from out of province, they have to accept them. So parents, you can do this for a year, you can do it for half a year, you can change programs. The only thing is if parents do not sign up for home education by September 30th, that's the deadline, they lose their funding. But they can still put their kids back into school. And
Judy,
there's no testing.
Beautiful. Okay, tell us what the best way is for people to see the online curriculum so that they can get the confidence and be able to make the choice. What is your website so people can follow along?
It's albertahomeschooling.ca, and you want to look under the How to Homeschool tab.
Awesome. Have you seen a big uptick in parents wanting to do it?
Oh my gosh, huge.
Can you quantify it so we have some idea?
Last year there was about 11,000 home education registrants in the province. This year our Facebook group has over 8,000 people already, and school hasn't even started yet.
All right. Well, we'll make sure that we check in with you throughout the school year. Thank you so much for giving us the guide. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
You got it. That's Judy Arnell, president of the Alberta Homeschooling Association. Now, what's the difference? You heard what a home educated program looks like, directed by parents, where you get $850. We're now going to hear from Lisa Davis about what she thinks about what the hub learning is going to look like. Stay with us. We'll be right back on 770 CHQR. All right, guys. So that is homeschooling. Parent directed, you can have a relationship with the school board or not, and you get $850. The other thing we'll call hub schooling. That is offered through a school board. Now, here's how it's going to work for the CBE. Real-time online learning is scheduled by the teacher for all students registered in the hub class together with the teacher. Students must be available for the following real-time learning. Grades 1 to 6 is 5 to 6 hours per week. Grade 7 to 9 is 5 to 7 hours per week. Grades 10 and 11 anticipate 2 hours per week per course. If you take 5 courses, that's 10 hours per week. It's pre-recorded videos. They'll be made available by the teacher to the students and with access through D2L, I guess that's direct to learning, by Brightspace or Google Tools. Videos provide additional instruction to facilitate both real-time online learning and independent work. Independent work through student assignments will reflect the learning for each subject curriculum as defined by Alberta Education. Assignments will not be identical to the work of their peers in the classroom, but the work will be addressed with the same learning outcomes. Grades 1 to 6, independent learning will be 3 hours per day. 7 to 9, 4 hours per day. or 1 hour per course, and grade 12, approximately 1 to 2 hours per day of independent learning. And then parent support learning is required and will depend on the age of the student and individual ability to work independently. So you're going to be involved one way or the other. Now, is this a good program? Lisa Davis was a school board trustee. She's got a few opinions on this, and she joins us now to talk about it, give us her take on it. Lisa, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good morning, Danielle.
So I was reading from an email that you sent me that described the hub approach that is going to be taken. I believe this is just at the CBE, or is this what is directed from the province? Give me some idea of who came up with this plan.
So this was CBE's plan, and I will give CBE credit because they have put a lot more detail about their expectations than the Catholic Board has. So still, I think that leaves lots of unanswered questions for parents. And when you look at the ratio of, you know, direct teacher instruction to what's expected for parents to do at home, I think it's quite problematic. So
yeah, I want to talk to you about that, because essentially it's down to, if it's 5 to 6 hours per week, it means for most of the time, your kids are going to be sitting in their seat with direct instruction, maybe 1 to 2 hours a day, most likely one. That's going to be a bit of a challenge, I think, for a lot of parents to think, oh, can you really get all the education that you need to in just 1 hour of direct instruction? What's your thinking?
Well, I have to say I was surprised to see this format, because it's essentially a repeat of what happened in the spring. And, you know, in the spring, it wasn't online learning. It was emergency learning. And everybody scrambled to get a program online. And that's totally understandable. But I have to point out as well, there was a significant difference in what the two major public boards offered versus what charter schools offered. And so many charter schools essentially went online when they resumed at the same hours they were during the day. And CBE went to this, you know, 1 hour a day of instruction, and in high school in particular, this 2 hours per week per course. So to see it formalized here is surprising, because it did not meet the needs of students in the spring, and I don't see how it's going to meet the needs of students who choose this. And I think the other thing that's really important to recognize is that this will become the default in the event there is a shutdown again. And so this one-third direct instruction and two-thirds independent learning works for a very small proportion of students who are, you know, highly motivated, highly disciplined, and who essentially have a parent at home that can direct that learning.
Well, and if you're going to do that, then why not just go the homeschool approach, where you can direct all of the learning rather than being locked in to sitting for an hour a day at a prescribed time? If the parent is going to be essentially responsible for the full education program, I'm trying to understand what advantage the hub offers.
Well, I think there's the reality is in the preparation of the lessons and the accessing the materials and all of that. I mean, it's a huge undertaking for a parent to go online and source that themselves. And so, you know, I know your previous guest probably has a lot of resources available, and I know there's lots of resources for homeschooling. But it is a significant undertaking. But in particular, as you look to these older grades, you know, you're taking Chem 20 at the high school level. You have 2 hours of instruction a week instead of 8 hours of instruction a week. Your tutorials, which are 40 minutes a day, have largely disappeared. And I'm not sure how we expect. We're essentially treating our high school students like university students, but without providing them with the lectures. Mm. And so again, when you look at, as a parent, having to choose this option and having to do so today, now CBE is allowing parents to cancel for September 1st, but you're committed within CBE till February, and with the Catholic district, you're committed all year. And I don't see how practically they're going to enforce this. What is a principal going to do when a parent comes to them in October, November and says, you know, my child is dying on the vine here, this isn't working for me, and they have to stay there for the next 6 months? I just I just don't see how this is practically going to work for the students who probably need it the most.
Give me, just in the last minute, what would you have done differently? What do you think would have been a better way to deliver this hub learning compared to, like, they should have learned some things in spring. If it was optimal, what would they have done instead?
Well, you know, Khan Academy, who is arguably the most successful online learning platform, talks about the need for that direct engagement with the teacher is critical. And so I would have, they should have increased the number of hours per week that is scheduled direct time with the teacher. And I think that will be critical, and I really hope that the two boards reconsider this approach as they start the school year.
All right. Lisa Davis, thank you so much for giving us your insight. That's Lisa Davis, former CBE trustee for Wards 6 and 7. So quite a different approach between hub versus homeschool. Quite a different approach, again, between what your experience is going to be for your kids in the classroom versus online. I mean, maybe the upside is that if you get the right content in those videos, if you heard what Judy said, that you can drastically reduce the amount of direct instruction. But you guys have a lot to think about, especially since you're kind of going to be locked in until February the 1st. Maybe the solution is, if you have the ability to give it a try for this next week, and then you don't have to lock in until September 1st, you'll get a pretty good sense of whether or not your kids are going to be able to do it. And then I guess the other option is this. If you go back to school and it's shut down, or you go back to school and you don't like the environment, you actually always can go back to the homeschool option that we outlined at the beginning. It allows for you to have that flexibility if you have the time to invest as a parent or with both parents in splitting up those duties. I don't know, friends. Like, it's a hard decision to make. Would love to know which direction you're going. You can give me a call, 403-974-8255. We begin our call-in segment when we return after news on 770 CHQR. Well, he's back. He must have timed his vacation so that he would be able to be here so he could talk about the conservative leadership race outcome. I'm talking about Rob Breckenridge, who will join you in about 20 minutes' time, but he's going to give us a sneak peek about his take and what he's going to be talking about this afternoon. So what is your take, Rob? Welcome back, by the way.
I was getting, thank you. I was getting worried that they'd have it all resolved by 12:30 today.
I know.
It's good. I think it was a little embarrassing for the party. Ultimately, look, I mean, it's now about Aaron O'Toole and how he performs as leader. I think, some of the snafus from last night will soon be forgotten. Look, I wasn't all that surprised, to be honest. I mean, Peter McKay was sort of billed as the front runner, but he just ran a real uninspiring kind of stale campaign. And Aaron O'Toole really seemed to have kind of some moxie. I mean, he's a skilled politician. He's a smart and articulate guy. He certainly has a lot of strengths that I don't think Andrew Scheer had, and doesn't have the kinds of weaknesses that Andrew Scheer had. So I think, given all of that, and given the problems the Liberals have found themselves in, and certainly I've missed a lot on that front the last couple of weeks, I think things are looking pretty good for the Conservatives at the moment.
Well, let me ask you, I get the sense that he's actually a unifying candidate. I haven't had anyone text today saying, Aaron O'Toole, I'm out. Yeah. It seems to me like he was able to somehow bridge that divide and keep the Peter McKay supporters in, as well as the Leslyn Lewis and Derek Sloan people in. Is that your take?
Yeah, I do. And I think he knew how to run a campaign. I mean, I think we'll see an Aaron O'Toole in a general election that is not the same kind of politician we saw in the conservative leadership race. But I think he was able to speak to small C conservatives and to do so with credibility. I mean, he hasn't been, the most hard right conservative as a member of parliament. He's pretty mainstream in most respects. But I think he understands the various, factions in the party. And as you said, I think he did a pretty good job of kind of bringing everybody together and not really isolating any faction. You don't see any group of conservatives that really seem upset about this outcome or have a big problem with this guy. I think he treats social conservatives with respect, but I don't think he feels obligated to their cause. And he certainly doesn't have that kind of social conservative baggage. So, I mean, he did well in Quebec. He's certainly articulate in French. So, you know, he doesn't have maybe the name recognition that Peter McKay had. And maybe to some progressives, it's just there's another, you know, boring white conservative. But I think, you know, he's going to be a much more formidable challenge than Andrew Scheer was. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he does as leader. So we're going to certainly talk more about that. Elise Mills, conservative analyst, is going to join us too. And she's got some really interesting thoughts on all of this.
Right on. That's Rob Breckenridge coming up in about 18 minutes time. All right, guys. I've got a few things that I want to share with you. I guess the only conservatives that seem to be upset are conservatives like Maxime Bernier, who, as you've heard in the news, is saying now he's just going to revert back to being the progressive he always was. My take on that is, you know what? I don't think that that harms Erin O'Toole, because those of you who watched his campaign, who know him, who saw how he campaigned, I'm pretty sure that you're not going to believe that all of a sudden he's turning into a progressive. That being said, having Maxime Bernier say, look how progressive Erin O'Toole and the conservatives now become, that might actually open some minds in downtown Toronto and in Quebec. So I don't know. I think Maxime Bernier can speak all he wants. I don't know that it's going to impact your vote. You guys will have to tell me otherwise. All right. Someone's mad at me. It always happens. Saying that they don't like the way that I mock people that I disagree with. And it's mostly on masks. Let me try to, with a non-mocking tone, be quite serious with you about the choices that we are facing. I don't talk about COVID every single day, but I do try to show you the extreme differences between different jurisdictions, because I think we tend to think that the direction our government takes is it's immune from looking at what else is happening in the rest of the world. And it's not. We're getting pushed in one direction or the other, and it's up to you to push the direction you want it to go. So this Tel Aviv University professor really spoke to me, saying, is Professor Udi Kimran, and one of you sent me his comments, he says, history will judge the hysteria. He's going to soon head the Department of Clinical Microbiology and Immunology at Tel Aviv University. And in an interview, he said this: there's a very great interest for anyone who has supported the draconian measures taken around the world to say that Sweden's policy has failed. Because if it succeeded and trillions went down the drain for no reason, someone will have to answer for it. That is why all over the world, they prefer to claim that Sweden was wrong, but in the end, the truth will come to the surface. In a world where decision makers, their advisors, and the media were able to admit their mistake and the initial panic that gripped them, we would have long since returned to routine. The ongoing destruction due to the inability to admit this mistake, despite the epidemic's small mortality numbers, is outrageous. History will judge the hysteria. If we had not been told that there was an epidemic in the country, you would not have known that there was such an epidemic, and you would not have done anything about it, he said emphatically. The fact that this issue runs all day in the media inflates it beyond its natural dimensions. If Black Death had raged here, as in the 14th century, you would not have had to follow the situation in the news. The bodies would have piled up in the streets. We were not, and we are not, in this situation today. Somebody says, let me just continue on because this guy's speaking to my heart. He went on to explain that infection in children is a welcome thing because it protects at-risk populations. For the same reason, I would open up the whole education system because the vast majority is made up of people who are not at risk. Of course, a solution needs to be found for teachers suffering from diabetes or other background issues, but I see no reason to prevent activities that encourage the economy. Not only because it also allows parents to go to work, but also because it lowers mortality in the long run. I would also ask children and young people to take off their masks. Of course, it is impossible to force a child to take off a mask, but proper information will do the job. At the same time, I'd call on at-risk populations, our parents and people with background illnesses, to avoid social gatherings in the coming months until we reach the appropriate immunity depth. It is possible and desirable to recommend at-risk populations to wear masks. I would also open the skies and abolish the isolation obligation for those returning from abroad. With this situation of carriers abroad compared to within Israel, there is no reason to isolate tourists, just as you and I are not isolated, even though we have an even higher probability than that of a random tourist from abroad to be a carrier. These are things that got into our minds 4 months ago, and we do not understand that their time has passed. On that note, actually, somebody did send me a screenshot of the last death of somebody who was under the age of 60. It was 4 months ago on April the 23rd. Things have changed, and yet our mindset is getting to a point where we think things are getting worse and worse. Now, I want to tell you a tale of two places. I want to tell you a tale of Wuhan, where the outbreak began, and a tale of Australia in Victoria, where they are now seeking to have a lockdown extended for another entire year. These are the two poles that we're facing. So first of all, let's play clip number 7 so you can understand what's going on in Wuhan right now.
The Chinese government is defending images and photos that emerged of a crowded pool party in Wuhan this week, which went viral on social media. The Chinese city was, after all, where the global health crisis was first detected last year. But the amusement park that hosted the busy event was backed by the government on Thursday.
This shows that Wuhan's fight against the coronavirus has achieved a strategic victory.
State newspapers, China Daily and the Global Times also celebrated the event. They said the festivities showed life was back to normal in Wuhan. Strict lockdown measures earlier this year in the city and across China helped slow the health crisis. On Thursday, China reported its fourth straight day of zero locally transmitted infections.
Okay, so Wuhan, pool party. If you go online and look at the images, it's got to be tens of thousands of people who are at this pool party. That is the state of things in Wuhan. Let's compare that to where things are at in the province of Victoria. Because again, friends, we've got a choice of which direction we're going to be pushing our government to go. And so that is communist China allowing tens of thousands of people to gather for a pool party in the place the outbreak occurred in the early part of the year. Fast forward to their neighbor to the south and see what is happening and what they're contemplating in Australia. That is clip number 8.
Good evening. Daniel Andrews is facing a fierce backlash after launching a push for the power to extend Victoria's state of emergency until September 2021, even though new infections have just hit a 7-week low. If the Premier gets his way, coronavirus restrictions could be enforced for at least another 12 months. His critics claim he's on a power trip.
Face coverings, stay-at-home rules, density limits and COVID carriers forced to isolate, all enforced under a state of emergency. But its six-month limit expires in 3 weeks.
This virus won't be over on the 13th of September.
So the Premier wants to extend it by 12 months, despite Victoria's downward trend with 116 new cases, our lowest for 50 days. There were 74 new cases on July 5. There are 15 more deaths, all over 80 and all linked to aged care outbreaks.
I hope we're wrong in predicting that this will still need rules in 12 months. Hopefully we've got a vaccine by then, but even then, the vaccine will take time to develop, to manufacture, to administer.
This is the act of a megalomaniac.
To approve the state of emergency extension, Parliament needs to sit and the legislation needs to pass. Neither are assured yet.
I'm asking respectfully people of all political persuasions to support those changes so that we've got the rules that keep us safe.
I'm just dumbfounded. I am furious. He has sent a signal to every potential investor outside of Victoria that this is not the place to invest next year.
This is not the act of a Democrat. This is the act of a Premier whose power has gone to his head.
12 upper house crossbenchers need to be convinced, including Fiona Patten, who found out about it on TV.
The lack of communication from the government does not breed confidence. It does not breed trust. I think using emergency measures for beyond 6 months is a sledgehammer. It is the wrong tool.
And will the Premier lobby disgraced former Labor MP Adam Somurek, now a crossbencher?
No, I certainly won't be speaking to Mr. Somurek, but I would hope that he could see the logic in this bill.
The opposition, the Liberals and Nationals, will be opposing this power grab with everything we've got. Victorians don't deserve to be locked up in their homes for another 12 months.
If the Premier does not start easing these restrictions from the September the 14th anyway, then the state is going to collapse.
I would say to them, we've got to protect public health.
Masks continue to be a key defence, and that's likely to continue in some way through summer.
Yes, that will be challenging when it comes to the hotter weather.
Masks are going to be part of our life for the foreseeable future. We're going to be having these for many, many months to come.
But it's a decision that can't be predicted yet.
I think we'd all be more than happy if the biggest challenge we face in a few months' time is the fact that it's a bit hot to wear a mask when it's 35 degrees.
This will all be very last minute. The Premier wants to introduce this legislation into Parliament next week. But there are a couple of hurdles. First, there's no agreement yet on whether Parliament should even sit. And then there's the tricky issue of trying to get this extension legislation through the upper house. So, Mitch, a couple of new battles for the state government to be fighting.
Yes, indeed. Paul Dowsley on Swanston Street. Thank you.
Wow. You know what, guys? Like, look what he is saying, that you cannot have any freedom back until they've identified a vaccine, manufactured a sufficient portion, and distributed it to all of the residents of Victoria. So who is the authoritarian leader now? Xi Jinping, who allows a pool party in Wuhan? Or is it the governor of Victoria? And which direction do you want to go? This is the consequence of believing you can get to zero. Guess what happens when you believe you can get to zero? You end up with zero freedoms. Let's take a pause. We'll be right back on 770 CHQR. All right. A listener says, oh, don't be silly, Danielle. Australia bears no resemblance to us. We don't have a wannabe authoritarian. We're not an old colony of the UK. We don't have the same system of government. We're kind of exactly like Australia. Never mind. Yikes. We just have to watch these things, friends, because bad ideas, they have a way of spreading like a virus. We got Ken, we got John, and we've got, who else on the line? Jim. Oh, sorry. Ken and Jim and one other person whose name I can't read, but he'll tell me. Ken, you're up.
Hi, Danielle.
Hey, Ken.
Your guest that you had on earlier, I agree with him on some points, but disagree with him on making drugs illegal, the illicit drugs. I think what should happen is they should keep it illegal, but when they catch these people with the illicit drugs, put them in a recovery plan for a couple months and then incarcerate them for a couple months.
Yeah.
Get them clean before they go to jail because they're not getting any treatment in jail. So let's treat the addiction, show them that there's a better way of life than doing their drugs. Get them clean, then get them incarcerated and let them spend the rest of their time.
Ken, I think that would be, I'm with you. I think it'd be a far better approach. You've got to have getting clean of drugs as the ultimate end. The enabling and allowing people to continue on for years, enabling an addiction, I don't think that's healthy for anyone. Jim, I'm going to give you the last word today. What's on your mind, Jim?
So just real quick, with Aaron O'Toole winning the leadership is, I'm wondering if, I think we're seeing him as a savior for Western Canada, but we're not, I don't know if we're seeing him as a savior for Canada. Like, what's he going to do to get things going for the whole Canada to come together? Like, I'm still not sure. I really am not sure. I think we're seeing it as a more than it really is.
Well, Jim, I know you're skeptical, and I think that's, I think it's a legitimate to be. And so we will see what we can do to try to get Aaron O'Toole on again. I promise you when we do, I'll let you know with enough advance notice so that you can give me your questions. But we'll aim to get him on. Let's take a pause. Handing off to Rob Breckenridge in Afternoons. Do stay with us. News is next on 770 CHQR. Thanks for listening to the Danielle Smith Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts. And join the conversation. You can reach me on Twitter at @ABDanielleSmith
or by email at danielle@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.